I'm going to echo Mr. Hendrickson's statement at the beginning. You know, thank you guys very much for all of this extremely hard work that goes into putting these kinds of weekends together. There's so much that goes on behind the scenes that we don't see, you know, and all of the chaos sometimes of trying to organize things and get everything done. So we truly do appreciate it. We know it's not easy, but these opportunities for our brethren to get together are just absolutely crucial, especially for our teens and our young adults that are so far-flung these days in different locations. It kind of gives them a chance to get together with the rest of the team. You know, this past school year, I had the opportunity to join the coaching staff of my school's track team. I've always enjoyed the sport of track and field. I'm not a runner. Well, I am sort of a runner, but I wasn't then at the time when I was in school. And to me, it's really the perfect mix of an individualized sport and a team sport. On one hand, you're competing against yourself. You're competing against your own personal records and your own scores, working to kind of beat your own times. But then on the other hand, ultimately, the team score wins the day. Now, I coach the field side of things, so I coach some of the throwing events. And while I love that side of things, you know, it's interesting to me, the real excitement of the sport comes from the track side. It's not that I don't enjoy watching these guys, you know, get out there and grunt a bunch and throw these big, heavy things around, but there's something just exhilarating that comes from seeing a well-run race. You know, watching a runner make a perfectly executed start, make a solid turn, make a strong finish. I love watching all those long hours of training come together. And for me, it's personally the pinnacle of the events that you can see on a track event is the 4x100 meter relay. It is thrilling, it's technical, and most of the time the race is over in less than a minute. Each leg of the event requires a very specific type of runner. Once you identify those runners, you get them firing together on all cylinders as a team, it's truly a beautiful, beautiful thing. And in the 4x1, not only is the speed with which you run your race important, equally important, in fact, arguably even more important, is the effectiveness of your handoff. Particularly when you reach the Olympic level, where when you have individual sprint times that are often only off by hundredths of a second, at that level, the race is won in the handoff. You know, in a perfect world, the incoming runner and the outgoing runner manage to match their speeds inside of this 20-meter box known as the exchange zone. Again, in a perfect world, they make the exchange without any errors, without a loss of momentum and no loss of speed. And the outgoing runner is able to explode out of the handoff and run the next leg. Two more perfect exchanges later and bada bing, gold medal. Sounds pretty easy, right? False. It's not easy. Even amongst elite athletes, baton handoffs are a source of immense frustration. There's a certain trepidation that runners have over that small little cylindrical piece of metal. There are a number of factors that can all kind of converge at the wrong place and the wrong time to create an absolute disaster. And those disasters occurred for both the men's and women's 4x100 teams in the Beijing Olympics when both teams were disqualified for dropped batons right in the middle of the race. And these are some of the best runners in the world. Let's face it, handoffs are tough. And they're tough not just on the track, but handoffs and transitions in general are difficult. You know, in business, for example, some of you run your own businesses and have family businesses and small businesses. Not paying careful attention to the handoff can put even a successful business in the ground. There's actually a study done by the University of North Carolina where they examined a number of family businesses as they kind of underwent these successions between the founding generation to the next generation and on. And they ran some numbers. And the results are somewhat sobering for anyone who's planning on possibly passing on that family business to their children. The study showed that only 30% of family-owned businesses survived the transfer to the next generation. 30%. Of those 30%, 12% survived the next successive transfer, and only 4% of businesses were able to survive out to the fourth generation. In other words, only 4% of the businesses in that study finished the race. They were able to make three successive handoffs and cross the finish line. For the majority, 70%, the baton was dropped during the first transfer. One generation. Would you turn over, please, to the book of Joshua? Let's turn over to the book of Joshua. You know, in this particular passage we're going to look at today to start out with, we get a chance to kind of see Joshua, knowing that he really didn't have much longer, gathering the leadership at that time to him to impart upon them some kind of final words of wisdom. So we're going to be in Joshua 24. So if you turn to Joshua 24, we're going to actually begin in verse 1. Joshua 24 and verse 1. Joshua 24 and verse 1 reads, "Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers, and they presented themselves before God." So Joshua brought the leadership at this point in. Joshua said to all the people, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him throughout all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his descendants, and gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau I gave the mountains of Seir to possess. But Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. Also I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt, according to what I did among them. Afterward, I brought you out. Then I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea. And the Egyptians pursued your fathers with chariots and horsemen to the Red Sea. So they cried out to the Lord, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians, and brought the sea upon them and covered them. And your eyes saw what I did in Egypt. Then you dwelt in the wilderness a long time." You know, Joshua here is reminding them of God's unfailing promises, reminding them that he did everything that he said he would do. He promised them the land of Canaan. Here they are. He protected them. He kept them. He ensured their safety. Now he goes on to describe further miracles and promises that God had provided throughout verses 8 through 13. He brought them into the promised land, delivered them from the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, and all those other ites that happened to be in that land. He defeated Balak, delivered them from Balaam. He goes on to say, "He gave you a land you didn't labor for, olive trees and vineyards you didn't plant." In short, God was faithful. He did everything that he said he would do. And maybe it only happens this way in my head. I don't know if this passage reads this way in your head. But I can hear him building his crescendo as he says these things. Building this crescendo as he kind of works to this ultimate point. Words getting louder and more emphatic. Kind of very like William Wallace-esque, minus the blue face paint and the horse. But in verse 14, we see him say, "Now therefore fear the Lord. Serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord." Verse 15, "And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell." And then this very famous statement from Joshua, "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." But Joshua admonishes them here to make the call. He asks them point blank, "After I'm gone, whom will you serve? Will you make the right decisions?" Notice the people's response in verse 16. Verse 16, we see their response. It says, "So the people answered and said, 'Far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For the Lord our God is he who brought us and our fathers up out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, who did those great signs in our sight, and preserved us in all the way that we went and among all the people through whom we passed.'" And verse 18, "And the Lord drove out from before us all the people, including the Amorites who dwell in the land. We also will serve the Lord, for he is our God." Now, they recognized all the miracles that God had wrought, but Joshua still wanted to make sure that they understood what they were entering into. Verse 19, "Joshua said to the people, 'You cannot serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done you good.' And the people said to Joshua, 'No, no, no, but we will serve the Lord.' So Joshua said to the people, 'You are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen the Lord for yourselves to serve him.' And they said, 'We are witnesses.'" How long did that last? About 2 pages. Flip over 2 pages into Judges. Judges 2. About 2 pages. Judges 2, we're going to pick it up in verse 7. Judges 2 and verse 7. It's two pages in my Bible. If you're using a large print, it might be like, you know, three or four. But Judges 2, verse 7 says, "So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works for the Lord which he had done for Israel." So those that Joshua talked to in Joshua 24, the ones who saw all the miracles that God had done and had wrought firsthand, you know, they'd seen all of these things occur. Those who saw Jericho's walls fall, saw the deliverance of the Lord with their own eyes, they were faithful. Let's get forward to verse 10. Let's get forward to verse 10. "When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work that he had done for Israel." Just one generation removed from Joshua. One generation. Brethren, how does that happen? How does that happen? How do you go from a group of people who were faithful and believed to a generation that Scripture tells us didn't even know God? Or, for that matter, the works that he performed? Somewhere along that line, the baton was dropped. That generational succession was not successful in this case. Now, either the generation that of men that Joshua talked to in verse 24, something happened and maybe they struggled to get the baton to these individuals for a variety of possible reasons, or they made the handoff and the next generation simply dropped it. Regardless, the end result is the same. A generation of Israelites that fell away from God and into idolatry, setting the stage for continued disobedience. Brethren, the importance of nailing the handoff and successfully passing that baton from one generation to the next is paramount. With the time that we have left today, I'm going to examine three components of a successful handoff, and we're going to analyze the implications that it has on us in the Church of God today. Those three components, if you're taking notes, are the approach. That's when you have the incoming runner heading towards this exchange zone. The exchange itself, that's the actual transfer of the baton from one person to another. And then thirdly, the next leg. The person who has the baton jetting out of that exchange zone as quickly as they can. Now, in case you hadn't guessed it already, the title of the sermon today is Passing the Baton. Passing the Baton. So we have the approach, we have the exchange, and we have the next leg. Let's start with the approach. Let's start with the beginning of this handoff process. You know, as that incoming runner approaches the exchange zone, a number of things begin to happen. You know, you've got your outgoing runner that's kind of doing their final preparations. You've got kind of just waiting for this guy to hit a certain mark. And once he hits that certain mark inside of what's known as the fly zone, that's the zone where the outgoing runner begins to accelerate. Once that runner hits that mark, they take off and they go. They begin accelerating. But you know, up until that point, they have to patiently wait for that incoming runner. They have to patiently wait for that incoming runner to close the gap. Now, at the Olympic level, they're not waiting very long. Okay, these guys are doing hundreds in anywhere from about 8 to 9 seconds on these turns. Okay, it goes very, very quickly. And the interesting thing, it takes about 8 to 9 seconds to close the gap, and the handoff itself is about 1 to 2 seconds, depending. And so if you think about that, and you think about the amount of time counted off in your head, 1-1,000, 2-1,000, in a 20-meter exchange zone, it doesn't leave much room for errors. You know, I had the opportunity to give a couple of teen Bible studies this last year at the Northwest Weekend, so I have to apologize for some of you that were there. This is going to be a little bit of a repeat because it's been a topic on my mind a lot lately. But I had a chance to gather some kind of interesting data, and I want to see if it kind of works out the way that it did in there. I had about 40 of the teens and young adults in this seminar at the Northwest Weekend. And I was really curious, just from a standpoint of ages to a degree, would you please raise your hand if you're under the age of 20? Nice try, Mrs. Moody, I saw that. It is her birthday, by the way, today. 19, again and again and again. So, how many again, one more time, under the age of 20? Folks, look around. 20 years was 1995. The people whose hands are in the air today have no physical, visceral, any kind of connection to what happened in the church in 1995 other than what they've been told and what they understand of it. And, of course, ramifications that came from that. Okay, those of you that had your hand up, put them back up again. Okay, we're going to add another age group to this. If you're under the age of 28, would you include your hand, please? Under the age of 28. That's the mark of Mr. Armstrong's death, 1995. 1986. Now, I'm going to stretch that out just a smidge because I'm going to assume some of you are like me and you were maybe 5 or 6 when Mr. Armstrong died. So if you're under the age of 35, would you raise your hand, please? Folks, look around the room. Now, I've stacked the deck because it's a teen and young adult weekend. I have stacked the deck. However, the point being, when we take a look at the demographics in our church today, you know, the folks that have their hands raised, these are individuals that really have no direct personal connection per se or context to either of these dates. You know, when we reference 1995, those of us that lived through it, we have a visceral reaction. We feel it in our gut when we mention 95, okay? But people who have no connection to it, it's just another number. And granted, they know academically something happened, but they don't have the same visceral reaction. I was 14 in 1995, and I was sort of not really all there at 14. You laughed. Some of you knew. Their understanding is really purely academic in that case. There's not that visceral reaction. And, you know, to be fair, it's kind of the same with Mr. Armstrong. I was 5 when Mr. Armstrong passed away. I was 5 years old. I remember him, but just barely. I mean, I remember, you know, certain things. I've since watched a lot of stuff on YouTube. There's a lot of old World Tomorrow type programs and stuff on YouTube that are kind of neat to see. And obviously, you know, read different books and what we've been taught. Others of you guys, though, you have a much more direct connection, a much more personal connection. You may have known him personally. You may have gone to Ambassador College and interacted regularly. I wasn't in that position. The point is, there are two very distinct generations within the Church of God today. You have those who have direct connection with Mr. Armstrong, have direct connection with Ambassador College, have direct connection with the ministry and have been at this way of life for a very, very long time. You also have a group of people who are coming up in the faith without that context. And one group called out of the world, another group brought up in the church. Two somewhat different outlooks and life experiences. Same faith, same goal, same gospel message, but two different backgrounds, two different outlooks, two different contexts to a degree. Brethren, we have a generation gap. Plain and simple, that's what that is. It's a generation gap. And because of that generation gap, it's really important for us to recognize it and work actively to close it and pass on the knowledge that you all have attained to the next generation. You know, God is a God of generations. How many times is he referred to in the Bible as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? You know, one of the features of this faith is the admonition that it get passed on. You know, our church is doing the Deuteronomy 6 model at this point in time and really focusing on that. How do we pass this faith on to our children? Or for those that maybe are past the point of children, you know, grandparents and whatever else, you know, how can you pass that on to the children that are in your congregation? But he's repeatedly referred to as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, by this faith, by way of design, this way of life that we've been called to lead, it's generational. Let's turn over to Psalm 145. Let's turn over to Psalm 145. Get a chance to see King David's thoughts on this concept. Psalm 145. And we're going to pick it up in verse 4. Oops. It's not going to do me any good to be in Proverbs. Psalm 145 and verse 4. Very specifically, David says, "One generation shall praise your works to another and shall declare your mighty acts." You know, David's pretty clear with this. We ought to be declaring, to a degree shouting from the rooftops, the mighty acts of God from one generation to the next. You know, when God's worked a miracle in your life, or when he's brought you through some sort of difficult trial, or when he's blessed us exceedingly, we should make those things known so the younger generation can see and can see that God works in our lives. This is important among our own children. You know, we try to often share those kinds of things with our own boys, but, you know, it's among our spiritual family as well. Important for people to see these things, to see that God's way works. But, you know, the other piece that we have to do is we also have to recognize we have a very limited amount of time to pass on that knowledge. Let's turn over to Psalm 71. See another of Psalms here, Psalm 71. And we're going to pick it up in verse 18 as David kind of contemplates this same concept of declaring the works of God, but also working in some thoughts on his own mortality. Psalm 71 and verse 18. Pardon me. Psalm 71 and verse 18 reads as follows. It says, "Now also, when I am old and gray-headed, O God, do not forsake me until I declare your strength to this generation, your power to everyone who is to come." In other words, God, don't forsake me. Don't let me die until I've had the chance to declare your strength, till I've declared your might to everyone who is to come. You know, David recognized he had a limited amount of time to declare those things. And you know, when we look out on the generational landscape of our church, we need to recognize we're sitting on a situation, and I don't mean to be the guy who brings the room down here, but we're sitting on a situation where there's a significant amount of knowledge and wisdom that is going to slowly fade away over the next 20 to 30 years. We need to recognize that, and I can't stress how important it is that that wisdom and that knowledge is passed on. There's a vacuum that is left when that is gone. There's a vacuum that is left when that is gone. You know, I remember after my dad passed away in 2008, you know, for those of you that didn't know him personally, Dad was a little rough around the edges, but he had a gift of being able to work on and fix and repair anything that had any kind of inner workings. I mean, he could think like an engine. He just understood how that thing worked. And he could listen to, you know, you could describe what was going on with your car over the phone. Call him up and go, "It's going clack, 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 clack. Oh, it's this thing." And sure enough, it was, just about every single time. But, you know, I remember after my dad passed away in 08, I used to call frequently when I moved out because I had a car that didn't like to run regularly. And, you know, it's interesting when you have a job and there's that little clause on the bottom of the application, must have reliable transportation. This was not reliable transportation. But he kept the thing running. But, you know, the thing was, he spent so much of my childhood out in the garage. And he was always tinkering on something. He was building this, or he was building that, or he was fixing this person's car, or working on my mom's car. But he was always doing those sorts of things. And you know, because he was a little rough around the edges, I often avoided spending time out in that garage to learn those skills. I don't have that skill set. I don't have that skill set. Now, once I moved out and I called and I said, "Hey, what's going on with this thing? Can you diagnose what's going on?" He'd tell me what's going on, and sure enough, you know, you look up the internet, YouTube tells you how to do anything these days. You know, how do I change a dot, 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 and you got a video right there that shows you. So once he told me what the problem was, I could fix it. But I remember right after he passed away in 08, I was dealing with an issue in my car, or with my car, and I picked up the phone, I called the house, I got the machine, I started to leave a message before I went, "Wait, Dad's dead. That's not going to work." And I was on autopilot. I was on complete autopilot. That was the procedure. Car breaks down, call home, get help. And I realized partway through the process that that vast resource of wisdom and knowledge was no longer there. And brethren, I don't want to get us into a situation in the Church of God where we look back and we realize that we let all that wisdom and knowledge quietly fade away. Bridge the gap. Impart that knowledge. Impart that life experience. Speaking as someone in that next generation, please do not wait until it's too late. The second thing that happens in a handoff is the exchange. And this is the fun part to watch in a race. And the stuff leading up to it and the stuff coming out of it's cool. But it is neat to see a perfect exchange. And when that incoming runner hits that predetermined mark on that track, the handoff process begins, the outgoing runner just goes. They're gone. They take off. And they're doing everything in their power to match each other's speed as they come through that 20-meter box. And if one's going a little too slow, we're going to have a collision. If one's going a little too fast, the other one's not going to reach them. It's got to be just perfect. But you know, if that baton's not transferred in that finite period of time, they're disqualified. If you don't pass the baton in that 20-meter box, if you somehow step outside of that 20-meter box and pass the baton, you're disqualified. Now, what makes it a little more complicated, at least at the Olympic level, is that the handoff is silent and blind. It's a silent, blind handoff. Now, what that means is this. At our level in middle school, the incoming runner will yell, "Hand." You can hear it from across the field. You know, kids getting ready to go and hear, "Hand!" And, "Oh, better put my hand back." You know, called hand. I got to put my hand back. You know, at the Olympics, They're in these loud stadiums. These world championships, they're at these loud stadiums. It has to be a silent call. They can't yell hand. They can't hear them. It's also blind. And what that means is that once the outgoing runner takes off, they run a certain number of predetermined steps. And then they throw their left or their right hand back. And they trust that that baton is going to be there. There's no verbal command. There's no looking back and pacing it out. Looking back and trying to run is slow. They just go. And they know that on step number 7, my hand goes back and that baton is there. Here it comes. Hit the mark, 1-1000, 2-1000, hand gone. That's the plan. Okay? It doesn't always go that way. But it almost has to be instinctual. And as you might imagine, this takes an extraordinary amount of coordination and practice. You're not going to take two runners who have never worked together before and somehow put them out on the track and expect that it's going to go well. It's not going to go well. We've seen it time and time again. It doesn't go well. A successful transfer takes an immense amount of practice in the exchange zone, working together. We have a term for that in our world today. We refer to it as mentorship. Call it mentorship. Two people working together on the same ultimate goal. It involves a very close relationship between two individuals that trust each other. And as time goes on, there's an increasing transfer of responsibility from one to the other. It's kind of, we call it in teaching, a gradual release of responsibility. In other words, at the very beginning, the mentor holds a lot of that responsibility and the mentee is kind of an observer. But as time goes on, the responsibility is transferred to the other person. But as that amount of responsibility is increased, the person doing the mentoring is present to support them as they develop. That's a very important component of mentorship, because that support is extremely important. One of the most used examples of a mentor-like relationship within Scripture is the example of Elijah and Elisha in 1 Kings 19. Jot it down. We're not going to turn there. I'm going to summarize the basic gist of it. We've been there a lot. But basically, God instructs Elijah to anoint Elisha as his successor. Elijah goes to Elisha, comes upon him as he's plowing a field with a giant team of oxen, walks up to him, and he places his mantle upon him. And as they go forward, pardon me, with that relationship, Elijah and Elisha work together for a time as Elisha learns the ropes. Okay, eventually, Elijah's taken up the chariot, and Elisha walks on his own from that moment forward. Okay, he'd been prepared. He'd been readied. Do you imagine that same story if Elijah tossed his mantle on Elisha and promptly died? Here it is. You know, Elisha looks down, and he looks at the mantle, and he looks at Elijah, and he looks at the mantle, and thinks to himself, what exactly do I do? What exactly do I do here? Mentorship was a crucial component of Elisha's preparation. And that time that he spent with Elijah was very important to his development as a servant of God. You know, we looked at an example of Joshua earlier as he was passing on his wisdom to the elders of Israel before his death. But how did he get there? You know, Joshua was an incredible leader of God's people. In fact, the statement that we read earlier is a great way to prove that. All the years that Joshua was alive, the people of God were faithful. The people who he trained, all the years that they were alive, the people were faithful. That's a hallmark of a leader. It's a hallmark of a great leader. They inspire those around them to develop and grow. But how do you get there? Let's go over to Exodus 17. How did Joshua get to that point? Exodus 17, we see an account of Moses delegating a very important task to Joshua. Exodus 17. We're going to pick it up in verse 9. We see the two of them working together with God's intervention, in this case to defeat the Amalekites. Exodus 17 and verse 9. Exodus 17:9 says, "And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose us some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.'" Okay, so Moses gives him a direction. We don't see Joshua argue about it. We don't see him try to negotiate. He just says, okay. Joshua did as Moses said to him, and he fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Verse 11. "And so it was, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed." You know, Joshua at some point may have looked back like, God, come on, keep those hands up. You know, we see him in the next bit, as his hands became heavy, they took a stone and they put it under him, and he sat on it, and then Aaron and Hur supported his hands on either side, one on one side and one on the other, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. Verse 13, so Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Verse 14, then the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You know, this shared experience would have strengthened their relationship significantly. Verse 14, we see God specifically tell Moses to record it as a memorial and to rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, to include him in the process, to have him be kind of a part of the work that Moses was doing. See Moses kind of undergo the process. See kind of generally how it works. A little further on in Exodus, we see another incredible example. Let's go to Exodus 24. Exodus 24. In Exodus 24, we see Moses going up to meet with God at God's invitation. See Moses headed up the mountain. Exodus 24 and verse 12. Exodus 24, verse 12. Exodus 24, verse 12 says, then the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and commandments which I have written so that you may teach them. In verse 13. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua. So we see Joshua's included in this process. Okay, it wasn't a thing where, hey, Joshua, you stay here, I'm going to go do this, and then I'm going to come back. Okay? It says, Moses went up to the mountain of God. Then he said to the elders, wait here for us. Wait here for us. Not wait here for me. Wait here for us. Until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has difficulty, let him go to them. So then Moses went up to the mountain, and a cloud covered the mountain. Notice in verse 13 again, Moses rose up and his assistant Joshua, his servant Joshua, and they went up. Verse 14 says, we will come again to you. Joshua was included in that. He was included and invited to this very personal meeting. He went up the mountain with Moses. It's not clear. I don't think he went up as far as Moses did. I think he was kept a short distance away, I would imagine. But he definitely wasn't left behind with everybody else. You know, having God working with him and having Moses as a mentor, you know, made Joshua into an extremely powerful and great leader. But Joshua was included. He saw the relationship that God had with Moses. He was close to Moses. That relationship developed him into an incredible leader, and it gave him a relationship with God. You know, there's a fascinating passage in Joshua that talks about how, you know, we constantly see him being admonished to, you know, have courage, have courage, have courage, be bold, be bold. And then eventually we see him go, stop the sun! You know, it kind of makes me wonder if God kind of went, okay, let's roll it back a little bit, maybe not that bold. But it does specifically say in that section, that is the first and last time that God hearkened to a man. Having God working with him and having Moses as that mentor made him into a great leader. You know, we see examples of this all throughout Scripture. We've got Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Timothy, Ruth and Naomi, Christ and his disciples. You know, the list of individuals that worked with other people in mentorship-like relationships go on and on and on. So the question comes from, or the question is rather, how can we in the church cross the generation gap and work on the exchange? I don't have a great answer. I'm throwing that out to you guys. How do we cross the generation gap and establish these mentorship type relationships? We have to be willing to commit to developing the next generation, praying for opportunities to assist in this very important work, and then increasing our focus on service to one another and fellowshipping across that gap. And I think that's one place we can start. You know, oftentimes when we get together and we talk with people, especially these kind of weekends, we get together with people we know because we haven't seen them in a long time. But there's incredible opportunities at weekends like this to cross that generational gap, you know, to go and listen to the experience and the collective wisdom of others, and vice versa, to be able to take your collective wisdom to other folks as well. The final thing in the handoff is the next leg. The next leg of the handoff is once that exchange is made and that baton is firmly in hand, the next leg is all on the outgoing runner. They have the baton and they are off. They're gone. Either they pass it to another leg, they give it to somebody else, or they get to be the one that crosses that finish line to hopefully a new world record and a gold medal. Young people, This is where we find ourselves today. This is where we find ourselves today. We're in the process of spiritually preparing ourselves and growing into and understanding and establishing relationship with our God in this life. We can't wish for the baton to get to us any faster. It's going to get there when it gets there. That baton will show up when it's ready. And when it gets there, we have to ensure that we're ready to take it. We have to ensure that we're ready to take it. You know, we're all called to be leaders. We're called to be kings and priests. You're being prepared in this life for a role as a leader in the kingdom and in your own family and in your congregations and in your school and at your workplace. You're being developed as leaders. You know, we sometimes hear that whole thing, well, if I can just be a doorman, you know, in the kingdom. Kings and priests. Kings and priests. You know, we all have roles in leadership with our families and with school and work and all kinds of other things. And you know, you never know where those opportunities for leadership are going to come from. I got to admit, if you'd have told me 16 years ago that I would be standing here giving you a sermon, I'd have laughed in your face. I said, no way. No way. Opportunity finds you. Opportunity finds you. We have to make sure that we're ready to do that. You know, it might be a request to give the opening prayer. Somebody comes up and says, hey, you mind doing that? How many times do we say no? Because we're not comfortable. That might be the opportunity. Maybe it's a request to help out on sound crew. Be part of the chair setup, takedown crew. Might be asked to lead a Bible study. You might be asked to be a counselor at summer camp. You might be asked by somebody to pray for and encourage them in their trial. That's leadership too. Maybe help cut firewood for a person in need. You might be called into the ministry at some point. Opportunity finds you. Okay, there's a huge laundry list of ways that you can serve. The question I have for you today is, what are you doing today to prepare yourself for service 15 years into the future? Or 5 years into the future, or 10 years into the future. What are you doing today? How are you preparing yourself today? And the question is also, when the baton does arrive, will you say yes? Will you say yes? You know, this topic has been on my mind a lot lately. And if you think of this faith as something that has been given originally by God and passed on from generation to generation throughout the ages, you know, from Adam to Seth, down the line to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to Judah, on down that line to throughout the generations to Christ, to his disciples, preserved and handed down to us to keep this way of life. Looking at our own lives as nothing more than another leg in this greater race is kind of sobering. To think of all who have come before, to think of how many hands that baton has been passed through. That baton was in the hands of Abraham. It was in the hands of Christ, of Paul, on down through the ages. I don't want to be the generation that drops the baton. You know, as you look at world events in the light of prophecy, it sure seems like the events prophesied in Matthew 24 are getting pretty close. You know, we don't set dates, but I can absolutely certainly assure you it's closer today than it was yesterday. You know, we don't set dates like that. But are we in one of the last legs of this race? Are we in the last leg of this race? You know, it's hard to know for sure, but regardless of whether we're running and handing it off to somebody else or we get to be the one that crosses that finish line, we have to run our race all out. Can't hold anything back. It's a one-way race. You don't turn around and go backwards, right? Got to give it everything. As a result, our spiritual preparation is so unbelievably important. You know, so that, again, when that baton does arrive, we're ready. Can we explain the fundamentals of our faith? If someone on the street asks you, like Mr. Hendrickson mentioned today, you're about to have a conversation on law versus grace, which I'm glad you asked that because that happened at the feast this year with a gardener in Kauai. It was an interesting conversation. Can you explain the fundamentals of our faith? Are we able to provide an answer for the hope that lies within us? Do we actively live what we profess to believe? Are we a light to the world around us? Do we show love? Do we flee sin and work to overcome it? If that baton showed up today, would we be ready to run the next leg? Is our relationship with God solid? Matthew 25 records the parable of the virgins. Let's turn over there really quickly. I'm going to paraphrase this. We go through this a lot. It's a frequently cited parable. But Matthew 25, I want to draw a couple of conclusions out of this as we begin to wrap things up here. Matthew 25. And if you take a look at Matthew 25, you know, you look at the parable of the virgins, you've got a situation where you have two unique groups of people here. You've got 10 virgins, you've got 5 wise, 5 foolish. The wise virgins were prepared. They were ready. They had the oil in their lamps. Foolish virgins had no oil in their lamps. They weren't ready. They were not prepared. Everybody slumbered and slept. The 5 wise and the 5 foolish. When the bridegroom came, the cry went out. The wise virgins simply woke up, trimmed their wicks, lit the lamps. Off they went to the wedding feast. While the foolish virgins, we sometimes use the analogy of running around with a chicken like your head cut, or like a chicken with your head cut off, running around trying to figure out where they're going to find oil. Oh, I got to go down and buy it from this person and that person. What am I going to do? Hey, you should give me some of yours. Nope. Sorry. Go to the people who sell it and buy some for yourselves. Well, they end up finally showing up. They do finally show up, but once they got there, the door was closed. You can kind of, it's a nice word picture here, but you can kind of see it in this passage. Just banging on the door, just knocking furiously. Let's pick up the account in verse 11. Matthew 25, verse 11. It says, afterward, the other virgins came also saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you. I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you neither know the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. I don't know you. We don't have a relationship. Who are you banging on the door? You haven't spent any time developing it. You haven't prepared. I don't know you. Let's look at it in a little bit different way. We're going to go back to Matthew 7. Matthew 7. We'll see kind of the other side of the coin. Same basic principle, but the other side of the coin. Matthew 7. We're going to pick it up in verse 21. Matthew 7, verse 21. Matthew 7 and verse 21. It says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, haven't we prophesied in your name? Haven't we cast out demons in your name? And haven't we done many wonders in your name? And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. But didn't we do all of these things? Didn't I check off my checklist? Didn't I check off my boxes? I did what you told me to do. But the relationship wasn't there. I never knew you. Same message given to the ones who didn't prepare and the ones who had kind of gone through their life a little like a checklist. That relationship with God is so unbelievably imperative. We have to communicate regularly with God. We have to listen to him. We have to let him guide our life. We have to allow him to prepare us. We have to submit our will. That's the hard one, is being okay with saying, okay, not my will, but yours. Scripturally, Moses and Abraham were referred to as a friend of God. Enoch and Noah were said to have walked with God, and David was a man after God's own heart. Those are terms of endearment. You know, these are men that had close relationship with God. Do we study the Word of God regularly to learn what God has to say to us? Do we communicate with God in prayer regularly? Do we actively work to strengthen that relationship? Because once that baton is passed, it's our race. It's all on us. Run in such a way that you'll obtain the prize. You know, as we wrap things up today, one of the most difficult components of the 4x100 meter relay is the handoff. Even the most elite athletes in the world struggle with this aspect of the race. But again, with similar sprint speeds, passing the baton successfully is what separates gold from silver. Unless you're Jamaican, in which case you have Usain Bolt, and he just kind of goes to the end, and so there's some guy that has speed. But can you hand off the baton effectively? Can it be done without losing any steam? Can you pass it without slowing down? You know, it's actually been said that a good 4x100 team's overall time should be faster as a team than their individual sprint times ordinarily. That they are faster and more effective when they work together than when they work individually. We need to recognize that if we're not careful, we can botch the handoff. We can drop the baton if we don't approach it in the right way. We need to ensure as we approach the handoff of leadership within the Church of God, whether it's family, whether it's work, whether, you know, wherever you may lead, that we're actively working to make that approach smooth. That we're working hard to make sure that that baton is where it needs to be, when it needs to be. We need to make sure as we enter that exchange zone that we're working together with the next generation in a mentor-like relationship, preparing them for the challenges that are going to confront them in leadership. We also need to ensure that we're passing on the wisdom and the collective experience of our years in the faith. Some of you guys have been at this faith longer than I've been alive. That collective wisdom is important. Very, very important. We need to ensure that as young people as well, those of you that are teens and young adults, that we are focusing on preparation. So when that baton is passed, we're spiritually prepared, we're spiritually ready to turn and run. Brethren, be ready. That baton is coming.